This is a North Carolina primary election special. I'm Jeff Tiberi at WUNC in Durham. This hour, public radio stations from across the state are collaborating to bring you context and analysis of the races and issues at play on this Super Tuesday.
I'm Amy Diaz at WFDD in Winston-Salem. I'll be looking at what's at stake for education in the state superintendent race.
I'm Steve Harrison at WFAE in Charlotte, where Mark Harris is attempting to mount a comeback in the state's new 8th congressional district, nearly 6 years after a mail ballot fraud scandal.
I'm Lily Knapp at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, reporting on a faith-based political coalition that's hoping to drive turnout in the western part of the state.
And I'm Ben Schachman at WHQR in Wilmington, where candidates are wading into housing and development issues here on the coast.
Candidates, issues, and the importance of a primary, all coming up after the news. Hello, Super Tuesday. Today is the 2024 North Carolina primary. Polls are open until 7:30 p.m. And this is a special statewide collaboration between public radio stations from across the Old North State. I'm Jeff Tiberi, host of WUNC's Due South, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. We're turning to public radio journalists from across North Carolina to bring you context, knowledge, and analysis of what's happening on this Super Tuesday. In a bit, you will hear reports from WHQR in Wilmington, WFDD in Winston-Salem, WFAE in Charlotte, as well as a report from Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Before those conversations, we're going to zoom out, take maybe a 1,500-foot view of what's happening across this primary landscape. And we're going to do so with Chris Cooper, professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University. He's on the line from Asheville. And we're also speaking with Deandra Rose, professor at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Chris, Deandra, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
At the risk of going cranky and cynical off the top, Super Tuesday. Do either of you feel super? I don't, like the vibe in this moment, it's hardly super to me. Deandra?
It feels like deja vu. I'm going to admit, there's something about this moment, and I'm a political, I love politics, and I'm feeling a little tired. And I think that's echoed in many of the electorate. Just the fact that we're still talking about candidates we've been talking about for years, and hearing a lot of the same political style on the national stage. You know, a lot of that is now being magnified at the state level, the local level. And I think, understandably, people are tired.
Go ahead, Chris.
I feel like I have a split personality on this. As far as the presidential end of things, I'm tired. I mean, it's the same two people. I feel like 4 years from now, if we don't watch out, at least one of the same people will be back. I mean, it's just the same old story again. Down the ballot, though, there's some really interesting stuff happening in North Carolina. I'm going to say some words that aren't often said together. The Republican primary for Commissioner of Labor is actually really interesting. Like, you've got all these fascinating races down ballot, and I hope we're not so blinded by the top of the ticket that we ignore all the action down below that's going to really affect our lives in some pretty significant ways.
Let's note right off the top that, of course, there's a presidential primary, and of course, it seems destined for who the nominees will be come this summer in Milwaukee and in Chicago. Barring an act of God, a major surprise, a quick jury verdict, we're going to see, we expect, a rematch of current President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. Here in North Carolina, there is not a U.S. Senate race here in 2024. There was a U.S. Senate race in 2022. But beyond that, as Chris notes, he alludes to one of the 10 Council of State races. There are 170 legislative races. There are 14 congressional races, and of course, some more localized races across the state as well. Is there a metric, an indicator, a particular race, something that you are honing in on as you look at this primary? Chris?
I mean, there's so many of them. I think at the state legislative level, Cecil Brockman's primary and Michael Ray's primary, two more conservative Democrats that are getting some significant challenges in getting some funding, it looks like, perhaps from the Republican Party. I think that's fascinating. The congressional level, there's so many. If I had to pick one, I'd say the 6th congressional district. And I think that one's really interesting because you've got four kind of top candidates. One of them, Addison McDowell, has gotten, of course, the Donald Trump endorsement. Beau Hines has gotten the Club for Growth endorsement. You don't used to seeing those two be too different. Mark Walker served at least in a district with that number of years ago. He's got higher name recognition. You've also got Christian Castelli just kind of hanging out there in fourth place. So I think that's perhaps the most interesting, but it's a tough competition because there's some other good races that I'm sure DeAndre will talk about.
DeAndre, I'm coming to you in just one moment. I want to touch on that 6th Congressional District that you point out, Chris. And if this doesn't embody the spirit, the culture, the constantly changing districts due to gerrymandering in our state, I don't know what does. And respectfully, I mean, you know, Democrats used to do this, Republicans do it now. Not saying it's okay, but I'm saying it happens. And in this 6th Congressional District that is currently represented by Kathy Manning from Guilford County, the contours have drastically changed. She's not even running for re-election because she would get thumped in a general election. So we have multiple Republicans vying for a place in the United States House of Representatives, and included is Mark Walker, who has served parts of this district previously. So I'm with you. I just want to re-up that. That's a really interesting Guilford County-centric district, the 6th Congressional race. DeAndre, give us one or two, if you would, something that you're honing in on and just really captivated by.
So I'm fascinated by the primaries for governor and the primary for for Attorney General, but also the primary for Lieutenant Governor is interesting. I think that's a place where there might be the most drama. So at the gubernatorial level, by many accounts, this is the most expensive and perhaps the most charged in the state's history, and for good reason. So we've got our sitting Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who, you know, is a really interesting candidate. You know, in my opinion, I feel like much of his style, it's a reminder of the former President Trump playbook. And he has made a number of comments that, you know, while they might play well enough during the primary season, that there will be questions about how they will fare, how he might fare in November. On the Democratic side, you've got Attorney General Josh Stein, who's in the lead. He's the front runner, but there are four others who are vying for that nomination. And I think it's worth noting that all four of them are African or Black Americans. At the level of Attorney General, we've got Congressman Jeff Jackson, who's running against Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry. And again, you know, it's a Black candidate who's running against a front runner who is white. And I think for the Democratic Party, that overwhelmingly relies on Black voters as part of that important voting coalition, you know, really not taking for granted the Black vote is something that I'm hearing among Black voters this cycle. And I think recent data, a February 2024 poll from Gallup showed that the Democratic Party is losing support, losing ground among African Americans and other Black voters in the U.S. So I think this is something to watch.
DeAndre Rose and Chris Cooper here on our North Carolina Primary Super Tuesday primary special. And as we think about Black voters in this country, Chris, feel free to go next level on this. But historically, Black voters tend to vote with the Democratic Party between 88 and 92%. That's going back half a century. And as we think about establishment candidates versus maybe some more extreme, I'm using air quotes here, or candidates that embody a faction of the two major political parties. I think DeAndre's speaking to it a little bit there, but what do you notice as it pertains to that kind of the different splices, the different ideological variety between some of these candidates on the within the Republican primaries and within the Democratic primaries?
Yeah, I mean, there are some clear, I think, lanes developing in some ways, but I don't see them as much about ideology as about style in some really interesting ways and about identity. So, I mean, if you take Mark Robinson and Dale Falwell and Bill Graham, for example, on the Republican gubernatorial side, you gave them a poll and you said, where do you stand on the major issues of the day? I bet they'd be the same on almost every issue. Yet, they seem like radically different candidates and radically different people. And so these primaries, I think this cycle, are less about ideology and more about personality, more about the way that candidates present themselves. Like Mark Robinson has clearly gotten himself in a whole mess of trouble for saying a whole lot of things over the last few years. Some folks think that is a good thing, right? They say, hey, look, this guy's telling the truth. This guy's, you know, telling us how it is, and sometimes he makes some flubs. Other people say this is not the kind of person we want as governor. None of those conversations revolve around his stance on any policy issue of the day. So I think these primaries are fascinating. I think they're arguably more important than the general election 9 times out of 10, but I don't think they're ultimately about ideology or policy.
I don't know if I have time to give you 9 reasons that you can lay out here, but I'd love for you to roll with that thought that I think you were just alluding to, Chris Cooper. Primaries are more impactful, more important than general elections in which notable ways?
Yeah, I mean, the primary way is our legislative districts. And by that, I mean our state legislative districts and our congressional districts. So if you look at our congressional district, we have 14 across the state of North Carolina. There's one of them that is perhaps competitive, that will be competitive most likely in the fall. That's the first congressional district in the northeastern part of the state. Don Davis, the Democrat, is the incumbent. The rest of them, you could put Donald Duck versus Mickey Mouse in the general election. As long as they have the proper letter next to their name, D or R, we could probably predict who's going to win. So the action is now. Our legislative districts, same thing. There's just not that many competitive legislative districts throughout the state. Out of the 170, there's a handful. And so the action is here. The action is now, because whether it's a D-leaning, meaning Democratic-leaning district, or a Republican-leaning district, we know which party is going to take it. We just don't necessarily know which person from that party is going to take it.
DeAndre, as an expert of politics and American politics and an observer, I'm wondering if you will touch on a misconception that you often see about primaries, or something that this time of year you're going, oh, people are missing it. People aren't, that's not how it works. I just have a hunch you have a misconception.
One thing that I would say, and maybe this is about primaries, but generals also, is that young voters are disaffected and counting, like sitting it out. And absolutely, there are young people who feel some sense of frustration. I was in a really interesting conversation over the weekend where there was discussion about just the age of the average age of an elected official in the United States, and a lot of frustration with the fact that the two people who are likely to be at the top of the ticket in 2024 are especially seasoned, I will say. And I think, you know, there are big questions, legitimate questions, about why our political system, why our governing institutions are not more accessible among people of the broad range of sort of age brackets or age decades. So I think that's an important question. At the same time, though, young people are paying attention. I think they're focusing on issues. And I think they're for all of the frustration with politics, they're still really invested in issues and invested in, you know, climate and gun safety, or you know, thinking about gun rights, reproductive rights. I think there's so many things that young people are paying attention to, and they are showing up in a number of ways related to them.
We're chatting with Professors DeAndre Rose and Chris Cooper on this Super Tuesday, and we'll hear more from them in a moment. This is the North Carolina Primary Election Special, a statewide production between public radio stations in Asheville, Winston-Salem, Charlotte, and Wilmington. I'm Jeff Tiberi at WUNC in Durham. Coming up, I'll also speak with reporters about some of the major issues and races that they're tracking on this election day. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to a statewide special focused on North Carolina's primary election. I'm Jeff Tiberi, host of WUNC's Due South in Durham. On this Super Tuesday, we're partnering with public radio stations WFAE in Charlotte, WFDD in Winston-Salem, Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, and WHQR in Wilmington. We'll speak with reporters about key issues that they're following coming up in a few minutes. But first, back to my conversation with Chris Cooper, political science and public affairs professor at Western Carolina University, and DeAndre Rose. She teaches political science at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. I want to turn our attention to third-party candidates. And I realize this might be blasphemy, but we're going to spend just a moment or two and note that there are third-party candidates on the ballot in many races, from statewide Council of State contests to even some legislative battles as well. As I mentioned, third-party candidate in this North Carolina primary, where does your mind go, if anywhere?
Honestly, to me, I think about larger structural problems in our electoral process and how we shape our democracy in the United States. I think that the fact that third party candidates are simply not regularly viable participants in these races is a problem. And I think that actually speaks to so much of the frustration that we see among many in the electorate. A recent Meredith poll showed that a pretty substantial proportion of North Carolinians view democracy as like a major issue. They say that democracy's on the ropes, it's under threat. And I think the fact that, you know, oftentimes you're given a set of candidates, a slate of candidates that don't necessarily reflect your preferences or what you're looking for, who you want to represent you, is a major problem. And then to your earlier point, the fact that we have lawmakers deciding, you know, elections essentially by drawing maps, you know, the gerrymandering, the districting that's used politically. I mean, people are fed up with it. I think they're pretty tired.
Chris, you penned an op-ed that was recently published in the News and Observer. You wrote in part that results are likely going to take a little bit longer to come in this North Carolina primary. How come?
Yeah, so there's this bill 747, and I know bill numbers are boring, but this might be one folks remember. There was a lot of action. This was the big election bill. Some people called it the jumbo jet bill of elections. And so it's like 29 pages or something. And so I don't think a lot of people paid attention to page 18. And so what page 18 says is that you can't start processing ballots until the polls close on election day. You say, well, how's that different? Well, in the past, what would happen is at 2 o'clock, on election day, all these local county boards of elections would start processing the early vote totals. And that's why it's 7:30. If you get on the North Carolina State Board of Elections website, you hit refresh a bunch of times, right? And then bam, you see the early voting totals. That's not going to happen this time. It's going to be pushed back a little bit. Now, depends on the county. Some counties may be able to do this very, very quickly, 10, 15 minutes. In bigger counties, this could be up to an hour. So they have to then run the machines at 7:30. They've got to get all the folks to be able to sign off, like physically sign off on the output from these machines and then upload it to the system. So there's going to be a delay and just a little bit of kind of pre-bunking here. When this delay happens, that is not a sign that the State Board of Elections or that county boards of elections are screwing up. Quite the opposite. They are following the letter of the law in Senate Bill 747.
Chris Cooper and DeAndre Rose chatting about the North Carolina primary, the Super Tuesday primary. Of course, North Carolina is not alone on an island in a vacuum here. Interested, if you would, let's make it a little lighter. We'll be a little lighter to end on here. Is it like a bowl of popcorn and a big legal pad? Do you have a whiteboard up in your house? Are you sipping seltzer water or scotch or wine? Like, how are you? Where are you? And how are you consuming the returns tonight? Lay it on us, Chris.
I will be in Asheville doing a little bit of TV. I'll be in a studio, and I will be furiously refreshing that North Carolina State Board of Elections website. Just like everybody else, I'll have my favorite stat package open, and I will be dropping data as they come and looking for patterns in real time.
DeAndre?
Same thing for me. I think I'll probably be at home, sort of hunkered down, refreshing, watching as much coverage as I can from different outlets, and it'll be an event.
DeAndre Rose is professor of political science at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University, and Chris Cooper teaches political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University. Thank you both for the knowledge and insight.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
This is a North Carolina primary election special, a statewide collaboration between public radio stations from across the state. I'm Jeff Tiberi at WUNC. We're going to transition from our political experts to our political journalists. Charlotte, Asheville, Winston-Salem, and Wilmington are all in the queue this hour. Let's first turn our attention toward the Queen City. North Carolina's new 8th Congressional District stretches east from Charlotte through mostly rural counties along U.S. 74 to Robeson County. With incumbent Dan Bishop running for Attorney General, 6 Republicans are trying to replace him in the U.S. House. One of them is Mark Harris, who appeared to have won a similarly drawn district 6 years ago. Then, a mail ballot scandal unfolded, allegedly masterminded by Harris's own political consultant, and it led to the State Board of Elections calling for a new vote. Now, voters must decide, does Harris deserve a second chance? WFAE's Steve Harrison has this report.
Voters in the 8th have been bombarded with this commercial from the Super PAC, America Leads.
It was called the nation's greatest electoral fraud, and it was Mark Harris's fault.
Harris looked to have won a 2018 congressional race by 905 votes, but the State Board of Elections ordered a new vote due to allegations of fraud. Harris supported that move, saying, quote, "I believe a new election should be called." Political operative McCrae Dowless, whom Harris hired, was later charged with illegally collecting mail ballots from voters in Bladen County. He died in 2022 before his trial. Harris, a pastor, spoke recently at a GOP lunch in a Golden Corral in Monroe. He addressed the scandal in a roundabout way.
Candidates and political powers with more than $1 million of PAC money are involved in the silliest ads and the silliest attacks.
He noted that Super PAC, America Leads, used to support a Republican who's against former President Trump, whom Harris wholeheartedly supports.
See, this PAC, America Leads, has ties to Chris Christie. I think we all know that name around here.
Harris then pivoted to his biggest rival in the race, Republican state legislator John Bradford. He lives in North Mecklenburg, which isn't in the 8th district. Bradford has said he will spend $2 million of his own money to win.
And one of the candidates in this race, and I'll just call him out, John Bradford, is very close friends with Tom Tillis. And together, their mindset has been that we're going to somehow buy the 8th district congressional seat.
Harris and Bradford attacked one another in a debate last month, while ignoring the rest of the field. Harris cast Bradford as a moderate who wouldn't support a ban on abortions after 6 weeks. Bradford said he was pro-life, though he didn't answer specifically whether he would vote for a so-called fetal heartbeat bill. Bradford also criticized Harris for his role in the 2018 scandal.
But the evidence was clear that they had hired someone on the campaign that had done election ballot harvesting, and that's illegal.
There are four others running: former Union County Commissioner Alan Baucom, Cabarrus County Realtor Lee Brown, former naval officer and author Don Brown, and Republican activist Chris Maples. A farmer, Baucom is lending his campaign $1 million of his own money. He's been endorsed by the sheriffs and district attorneys in Union and Stanley counties. He says he asked Harris not to run last fall.
One is that it's negative to Christianity. Two, it's a negative to his family. Why would you put your family through this? Three, that it's a negative to the Republican Party. And he said that he had won the election, he was entitled to it.
Since announcing his candidacy in September, Harris, who was never criminally charged, says he made a mistake when he asked the State Board of Elections to call for a new election during an investigatory hearing in 2019.
Keep in mind that that was based on the information that we were receiving in that hearing. So much more came out later.
He says there weren't enough questionable ballots to change the result. And he's upset that a former Democratic member of the State Elections Board was communicating with Harris's Democratic opponent, Dan McCready, before and after the investigation, according to reporting at the time by WBTV News.
So the more and more it began to take shape, that there was some kind of manufactured scandal here that had overturned an election, that's when I realized, wow, this is unbelievable.
That omits some of the facts, such as that the state elections director at the time, Kim Strack, was a Republican. And it leaves out the most explosive part of the scandal, Harris's own son, a prosecutor, testifying that he warned his father against hiring Dowless. And at one point in 2019, Harris's lawyers stopped him from testifying, worried that he might perjure himself. He says now, old news.
The people of this district know what happened, and they have their views, excuse me, sir, of what happened. And I leave that in the hands of the voters.
Harris says he's gotten some vitriol while greeting people during early voting. Others, like Joe Pomacatz of Union County, say they've moved on.
Everybody makes mistakes. I think his heart is where it needs to be.
If no one gets above 30%, there will be a runoff. The eventual Republican winner will be heavily favored to win the general election in November. I'm Steve Harrison.
Joining us now on the line
from Charlotte is Steve Harrison, political reporter WFAE, who has been tracking Mark Harris and following this 8th congressional district race. This is potentially a story about a political comeback, a resurgence of sorts. Steve, is Mark Harris the front runner from your perspective?
I think he definitely was when the race started in January. He had the most name recognition. Of course, he was on the ballot in most of these counties back in 2018. But since then, he has been attacked pretty relentlessly. I mean, on multiple TV ads, some attacking his record or his views, some attacking him for his role in that ballot scandal in 2018. And so there hasn't been any public polling on this. But what you hear from the other candidates is that Harris's support has softened a bit. I don't know if that's true or not. But again, we've got six people in the race. You've got to get to 30%. So we could be heading for a runoff.
What didn't make it into your piece?
Well, I think in this race, like I said, you've got six people running. All of them profess to be extremely conservative. They all want to impeach President Biden, et cetera. But there is a difference in terms of with John Bradford, the Mecklenburg state representative. Harris has tried to kind of call him out on this a little bit, but seeing him or painting him as the moderate in the race. And in a way, that's true because he's an elected official. I mean, once you become an elected official, you often deal in worlds of gray and not black and white. Bradford famously in 2022, when he was up for re-election, said he had no interest in going to Raleigh and rolling back the current limits on abortion, which was then 20 weeks. Now, he did vote for the 12-week ban. And Governor Cooper came to North Mecklenburg to try and pressure him to not vote with the Republicans on that. He did. So there's definitely an effort to make Bradford appear not as conservative, not as tough as the other candidates.
Steve Harrison of member station WFAE on the line. Transitioning just for a moment, final question. Feel like I would almost be remiss if I didn't note on another note, Tricia Cotham, the state house representative who famously flipped her party affiliation almost a year ago, going from an elected Democrat to a declared Republican. She is unopposed on the Republican side tonight in the primary for a house district seat, a state house district seat. Please give us a quick synopsis of what to expect or what you're watching, listening for on the Democratic side.
We've got three candidates running for the right to challenge Cotham. Terry Lansdale, Yolanda Holmes, Nicole Sidman. Yolanda Holmes ran against Cotham in the Democratic primary in 2022 and lost. The district is now different, though. It's been redrawn by the Republicans to give Cotham a better chance of winning. Nicole Sidman has raised the most money in this race. There is a sense that she is the favorite to win the primary and to then challenge Cotham in November, which will be, this may be the biggest state legislative race probably in Mecklenburg County's history, maybe in the state's history. I mean, this will be such a big showdown.
That will get lots of attention in the weeks and months ahead. Steve Harrison, political reporter from WFAE, thank you for the knowledge.
Hey, thanks, Jeff.
The position of North Carolina's superintendent of public instruction is up for election this year. And WFDD's Amy Diaz explains how this job influences funding, policies, and laws pertaining to public K-12 education, as well as what's at stake in this race.
Two Republicans and three Democrats are running for North Carolina superintendent, a role overseeing the state's public education system. According to Danny Parker Moore, the director of the school's education and society minor at Wake Forest University, it's a race to watch.
We're in a perfect storm of thinking about public education, a new governor, new superintendent, parents' rights advocates, bills, the expansion of vouchers to go to private schools. And our current governor has sounded the alarm that public education is under fire.
So what exactly is the state superintendent's role? According to the North Carolina Constitution, one of their responsibilities is to serve as a secretary to the State Board of Education.
Our State Board of Education is made up of 11 members that the governor appoints. There's people in there like Teachers of the Year, there's Principals of the Year, there's attorneys. So those people, they kind of monitor what's happening in the state. They make choices based on funding.
The superintendent has to attend the board meetings, keep members informed of things happening in public education, and make recommendations. They also have to supervise the Department of Public Instruction. DPI is charged with leading local districts, developing the content of courses taught in North Carolina schools, and administering state and federal public school funds. The superintendent is also responsible for reporting to the governor 30 days before each regular session of the General Assembly.
And they have to really include the stats of public schools with recommendations for improvement and changes in the school law.
So the superintendent can't enact or change laws themselves, but they do have some influence in their position, overseeing how funds are administered and highlighting for lawmakers what the problems are.
Part of it is like the lens in which you see the world. So it's like, what do you define as a problem? Whose problem? How do you see the problem?
For Democratic candidates C.R. Katie Eddings and Keenan Crumble, teacher retention and compensation are top priorities. Maurice Green, who was the superintendent of Guilford County Schools for more than 7 years, also highlights the need to revere teachers, fully invest in public education, and celebrate the good work happening in public schools. The Republican candidates, homeschooler Michelle Morrow and the incumbent, Catherine Truitt, share concerns around instruction related to race, gender, and sexuality. Truitt is also a proponent of expanding school choice and has been endorsed by organizations advocating for charter and private schools. Mike Long, the president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina, says he's been happy with Truitt for precisely that reason.
Parents want to be able to have the freedom and mostly the economic freedom to be able to choose a school that best meets the needs of their children. And often the school that is assigned to them in the neighborhood they live in does not meet those needs.
The state constitution specifies that the superintendent oversees the public school system. Tamika Walker Kelly, the president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, says supporting public education needs to be the superintendent's priority, which is why NCAE endorsed Maurice Green for the job.
We know that the state superintendent of public instruction's role is critical in shaping the narrative around public school, boosting morale and respect for public school educators, and also utilizing critical resources and strategies to support our North Carolina public school students.
Whoever is elected state superintendent will have the ability to influence the direction of funding, policies, and laws pertaining to public education. But how much power they ultimately have may depend on who else is elected in North Carolina this year. In Winston-Salem, I'm Amy Diaz.
Amy Diaz covers education for WFDD in partnership with Report for America. More of our North Carolina primary election special in just a moment. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Welcome back to our North Carolina primary election special, a statewide collaboration between public radio stations across North Carolina. I'm Jeff Tiberi at WUNC. We're hearing from reporters and experts on some of the most notable and contentious races this primary, as well as some of the most unheralded yet important contests on the ballot. Let's turn now to Asheville. The Blue Pocket sits in mountainous western North Carolina, though it is far from as far west as you can go in our state. Believe it or not, North Carolina extends 3 hours west of Asheville, and at that point, you're closer to five other state capitals than you are to Raleigh. These reaches of North Carolina are a deep red, Republican stronghold. And during this primary season, the local Faith and Freedom Coalition is focused on courting evangelical voters with social issues at the forefront in an effort to drive party turnout. BPR's Lily Knapp went to one of the coalition's rallies in Macon County earlier this month.
It's a cold Saturday morning, but the packed parking lot of the Holly Springs Baptist Church in Franklin makes it look like a Sunday. Inside, about 250 people gather, not for a revival, but for a political rally. The North Carolina branch of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, a Georgia-based national Christian political organization, has designed the event to introduce Christian voters to conservative local and statewide candidates for the 2024 primary election. Representative Chuck Edwards, who is running for re-election in Congress for District 11, started by leading the crowd with a chant.
Let's hear you chant the words, Donald Trump.
Edwards said he was at the event to talk about his relationship with Jesus.
When Chuck Edwards goes to support an issue, when Chuck Edwards goes to vote, he's going to continue to ask WWJD.
Edwards isn't alone. The Faith and Freedom Coalition sits at the intersection of two influential groups in Western North Carolina, conservatives and Christians. Political expert Chris Cooper explains.
I think this Faith and Freedom Coalition is trying to keep this marriage of evangelical groups, evangelical issues with the Republican Party. I think we need to remember this wasn't a foregone conclusion. It wasn't always clear that evangelicals would end up with the Republican Party. This was a concerted effort really starting in the 1980s, gaining ground in the 1990s. Some folks may remember the Christian Coalition, sort of the highlight or the zenith of that movement. But even today, these kinds of groups are trying to remind people to vote for Republican candidates, but also Republican candidates to highlight evangelical issues, to talk about more than just the economy, and to lean into some of these social issues that they believe in.
Ralph Reed is the former executive director of the Christian Coalition. He founded the Faith and Freedom Coalition in 2009.
Back in the days when magazines mattered, he'd be on the cover of Time, he'd be on the cover of Newsweek, again, championing those evangelical values.
Reed explained to the crowd in Franklin that the goal is to get every evangelical Christian to the polls.
Now, we've gotten the ball to the 5-yard line here in the Tar Heel State. Amen?
Amen.
We need to punch it through in 2024.
That 5-yard line is a supermajority for the Republican Party in the State House and Senate that provides veto-proof power for conservative bills. Reed says the next goal is the governor's mansion and then the White House. Far western North Carolina is solidly red. Trump won over 50% in the 8 westernmost counties in 2020 and 69% in Macon, where this rally took place. In recent years, western North Carolina lawmakers have become important voices in conservative policy in Raleigh.
If you're looking for where the power is in North Carolina politics, I mean, look, certainly it's with Tim Moore, certainly it's with Phil Berger, but at that next level down, a lot of it's coming from the west.
Representative Carl Gillespie from Franklin has risen quickly in legislative leadership since his election in 2020. He serves as majority whip in the assembly, making sure other conservative representatives follow the party line. Senator Kevin Corbin of Franklin is another Western North Carolina politician who has gained stature on the statewide stage. He was an influential force for Medicaid expansion, an unpopular stance in Raleigh's conservative circles. GOP leadership eventually came around to Corbin's viewpoint, passing Medicaid expansion in 2023, Cooper explains.
He's been known as a conservative senator, but one who is at least willing to have some conversations across the aisle.
During the event, Gillespie and Corbin took the stage to highlight their shared success in the legislature. They boasted about their efforts to lower the income tax and emphasized their work to restrict abortion access and social issues for the Christian crowd. Corbin talked about the bill that he sponsored, Care for Women, Children, and Families Act, which was passed by the House and Senate.
Carl, of course, we worked together on that, but we did. We dropped that from 20 weeks down to 12 weeks. Now, personally, I believe life begins at conception. I'm actually crazy enough to believe that life begins before conception, because the Bible says that God knew you before you were in the womb. So I'm kind of crazy enough to believe that. But we had to lower it to a point we could get the votes.
The bill had enough votes to sustain the governor's veto and ban abortions after 12 weeks, with some exceptions. The restrictions have forced some people seeking abortions to go to Virginia and other states. For Gillespie, the restrictions were not only a political victory, but a religious one.
I think we both agree it's not where we want to be, but it's a step in the right direction. It stopped the influx of folks coming into North Carolina for abortions. It was a great day for Christianity.
Gillespie told the crowd he hopes one day Republicans can completely ban all abortions. Corbin also highlighted the work by the pair to restrict transgender females from playing on middle school, high school, and college sports teams that align with their gender identity.
I never thought, as a little boy growing up, there would ever be an issue that boys went to play girls' sports. Never thought there'd have to be a law saying you can't do that.
They pointed to a volleyball injury in a local Western North Carolina game between Highlands and Hiawassee Dam as an example of a female player being injured by someone GOP officials have called biologically male. The volleyball player was never confirmed, to be transgender. Republican politicians highlight issues like abortion and gender identity to motivate a Christian conservative base to head to the polls. The party will use the primary as a barometer to gauge where successful candidates fall on the conservative spectrum. Cooper explains that's why it's important to vote in the primary.
Look, a lot of folks say, well, why should I pay attention to the primary? Why should I vote in the primary? And the reality is, if you want your vote to count, make a pretty credible argument that the time to vote is now, that so many of these races are going to be decided well before the general election.
I'm Lily Knepp, BPR News.
You just heard from Lily Knepp. She is senior regional reporter with BPR, Blue Ridge Public Radio, and she's with us here in our hour-long special to tell us a little bit more about her reporting. Lily, what did not necessarily make the final cut of your story as we think about religion in this March 5th primary in Western North Carolina?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to see this rally at a church. I feel like we've been seeing more of that in this election season. And I talk a lot in the piece about just the fact that this was in Franklin. You know, this is a really small town, but we've seen some our legislatures at the state level in Franklin and Macon County, Senator Kevin Corbin and Representative Carl Gillespie, you know, becoming bigger statewide players. And so I was really interested in thinking about what that means as we're headed into this primary season to kind of see some of that power from far western North Carolina. I would say a lot got left on the cutting room floor in this. It was a really interesting day. Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who is running for governor, was there as well. And during his speech, it was really interesting. He didn't talk about a lot of the same issues that Senator Corbin or Representative Gillespie talked about, didn't really mention abortion. And there was really a lot of discussions throughout the day about foreign policy.
One of the themes that we've talked about with other guests here in this hour-long special is the importance of a primary, but to go second level, the number of races that will be decided today on this March 5th, because districts are so heavily skewed to the right or the left. Highlight for us, if you would, a couple of races or contests that when we know the winner of today's contest, we'll almost assuredly know the winner of the November contest as well.
Yeah, here in far western North Carolina, a lot of the races are just at the local level. Democrats did a much better job this year than in the 2022 election of getting Democrats on the ballot. So most of these races that previously weren't contested actually have a Democrat and a Republican running against each other in the general. But these lower level local races, which are really important to the day-to-day lives of citizens in western North Carolina, a lot of them are going to be decided during the primary. In Jackson County, the school board race is going to be decided totally in the primary, and that's a special case where their school board election on purpose, though nonpartisan, is only taking place during primary season. And then in Macon County, because it is all Republicans, two county commissioner seats, those are the people who hold the purse strings for Macon County, are going to be decided during the primary election.
One of the things that Blue Ridge Public Radio, BPR, has done here in recent months is you have followed a community agenda. You've tried to institute a greater lean toward hearing from your audience as to what they want to hear about. Tell us a little bit about some of the issues that have bubbled to the surface when we think about the wants of your listeners and issues that are of the utmost importance.
Yeah, so we really didn't want to just follow the polls and who's polling up and what's going on at that level, but we really wanted to ask voters what they wanted to hear about. And it's really interesting, you know, we're talking about what issues are driving people to the polls. And I think, you know, this Faith and Freedom Coalition is a good example of, you know, talking about social issues, civil rights issues, same-sex marriage, abortion access, transgender rights. And there is a hope that those issues are going to drive folks to the polls one way or another. And when we reached out and asked our community to fill out a survey and let us know what issues they're really interested in hearing about from candidates, they said, you know, housing affordability, homelessness, these real like on the ground things that everybody every day, you know, they're trying to buy their groceries and they want things to be affordable.
Lily Knepp is senior regional reporter at Blue Ridge Public Radio. She joined us on the line from Silva, North Carolina. Lily, thank you.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
All right, let's turn our attention now to the Port City.
Wilmington is about as purple a jurisdiction as you can find in our state. A narrow majority of New Hanover County voters backed Donald Trump and Roy Cooper in 2016 and then again in 2020. It has been home to some of the most expensive legislative races, and issues ranging from education to the environment are front and center to many of Wilmington's residents. It's a ticket-splitting place with thin margins, and if you don't know, Wilmington and New Hanover are the largest city and county, respectively, east of I-95. For a little more knowledge and context, let's turn to Ben Shockman, news director at public radio station WHQR. What's the vibe heading into Super Tuesday? Sleepy primary? Fireworks? What do you got for us?
The big title fight at the county level, which is the county commissioner race, is very sleepy. Both parties did a good job of keeping their candidates in line. But school board is going to be a knockout drag down for the Republican Party in New Hanover County. And then in some of our neighboring counties, Brunswick County and Pender County, we're seeing some well-established conservative Republicans being challenged within their own party in primaries. And this, you know, this is not the first time that's happened, but there is a kind of anti-development vibe that we're seeing there that I frankly have not seen in the past.
Let's jump over, at least for a moment, to housing. There is an issue with inventory. There is an issue with cost. There are various issues across this state. Is there any nuance to this? Is there anything that's different in New Hanover, or is it much of the same? Rising prices and not enough options for people who need a place to live, whether they're renting or buying.
Yeah, I mean, it's only just more so because of how compressed geographically New Hanover County is. It's the second smallest county geographically, incredibly dense population. Wilmington is down to the last 2 or 3% buildable land. So what's happening is that we definitely need more stock, at least if you talk to any housing experts, that's what they tell us. But we're running out of places to put it.
Are there places that are, I suppose there's always or generally the option to build up? What are the options here? Are you telling us there are no options?
Well, in the city of Wilmington, yeah, up is the only way left to go, which is running into a tremendous amount of NIMBYism. We'll see this in the municipal elections in 25. We saw it last year. But frankly, Wilmington has a lot of nostalgia for a pre-80s era. We have a very low-key skyline. People remember there used to be a wooden bridge over to the beach. And so there are a lot of people for whom the idea of, say, a 20-story tower would just be absolutely inconceivable. And then when you pull out to the county level, which is the race coming up, you know, you have a lot of diehard people who are committed to the single-family suburban model. And we saw this in 2022, where we had a candidate who was willing to really stake most of his campaign on fighting against the idea of seeing mixed-use development, denser development in the unincorporated county levels. And I think we're going to see some of that fight again in the general election.
Remind us of who that candidate was 2 years ago, what they were running for, and how the race they were in turned out.
So that was candidate Tom Tobey, who, if I remember correctly, lost in the primary. But during a forum that we held here with our media partners, Port City Daily and WECT, he actually made some veiled allegations that, you know, sitting officials were doing closed-door deals with developers. We actually had to challenge him during the forum to get him to see if he could actually provide any evidence for those allegations, and he couldn't. But I can say he certainly speaks for a certain demographic who have moved to the area. People like living near the beach. They like the suburban model, and they're not happy about the prospect of seeing a mixed-use development in their backyard, even if that is the solution to the housing affordability crisis.
Ben Shockman is news director at WHQR, public radio station in Wilmington. He's also a veteran, former reporter of Port City Daily, a publication in Wilmington. I'm curious, Ben, stepping back for a moment, you've covered a number of elections. From your standpoint as a journalist, how has this one been different, either in the rhetoric, the temperament, the hyperbole of the candidates, and or the issues that are at play? Is this different, or is this, you know, a movie you've seen before?
Well, one thing that has definitely felt different, going back and looking at some of the last campaigns, I didn't see this as much, and that is incumbent Republican candidates in the very red counties down here, like Pender County or Brunswick County, being challenged by this kind of populist conservatism, especially when it comes to development. And these counties are bringing in a lot of tax base from development, and they also know that without building more units, the affordability crisis is going to crush them. Now, conservatives usually focus on workforce housing over and above low-income housing, or to say nothing of the homelessness issue. But still, it's very difficult to find a Republican who doesn't know that affordable housing is the only way you're going to save teachers and nurses and police officers. And if you can't offer them a place to live, you either have to increase their salaries or you lose them. So there's a lot of support across the political spectrum for workforce housing, and that means building units. And now we're seeing, again, this sort of populist insurgency from the right saying, no, we've got to protect green space. We've got to protect the environment. We've also got to protect the single family lifestyle. And these are complaints that would have been very well situated in the sort of more liberal democratic wheelhouse in 2017 and 2018. So I got to say, that has been something to watch.
All right, Ben Shockman with us here for another moment or so. Super Tuesday, where will you be on this Super Tuesday? And what is top of mind for you as you get to your reporting this evening?
Well, Jeff, I'll be out at the polls. I'm really interested to hear from people about the Board of Education race. I think there are a couple of different flavors of conservative philosophy represented in the candidates. And I really think that how people go on that race is going to show, at least to some extent, how New Hanover County is going to go on where the Republican Party goes in the future.
Ben Shockman is the news director at WHQR, NPR member station in Wilmington, North Carolina. Ben, thanks for all the analysis.
Happy to do it.
All right, we are just about out of time on this March 5th. A big thank you to everyone who contributed to this hour-long North Carolina primary program. Amy Diaz of WFDD, Steve Harrison of WFAE Charlotte, Lily Knapp of Blue Ridge Public Radio, and Ben Shockman of WHQR, as well as Chris Cooper of Western Carolina University and DeAndra Rose from Duke University, who you heard from at the top of the show. This hour-long program was produced by Aaron Kiever. Our technical director was Denarius Thomas. From WNC's downtown Durham studios, my name is Jeff Tiberi.